Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602. Or toll-free across the United States, it's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
Well, I just checked 682 comments in the comm box on the Jimmy Akin blog, the Go Get 'Em Boys Jimmy Akin comm box. 682 comments. I think I deserve some credit for that somehow. how to get an entire mob really angry over absolutely positively nothing. Amazing stuff. I'm going to be playing some stuff from Jimmy Akin today, which I had intended to do last week. In fact, I had come in, I had already, I listened to this particular, to the Bible Answer Man discussion last week, and in fact, I'd already started playing this, and listened, I believe, last Wednesday to the whole thing while riding. So before all this stuff blew up, it was already my intention to do so. It only made it more logical to continue it in light of what has taken place. If you have not been following the blog, last week set all new records for utter nastiness from a false religious group aimed my direction, and this time it was the Roman Catholics. It normally is. I mean, King James only folks are always nasty to me, but there's so few of them that even if they tried to get a mob together, it'd be a little bit like when some liberals here in Phoenix try to get together, and they have four people down there, and it's really embarrassing. And all the media shows up, of course, and then tries to make it look like there's 40 or 50 or 400 of them when there's only four. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. As far as major religious groups go, the Catholics are good at this. And when the Pope died, and I dared to point out that just being a nice old man doesn't get you into heaven, not only were the Catholics all mad at me, but so were a bunch of people who are not actually historically Protestants. They're just not Catholics by taste. They're not into popes and liturgies and stuff like that, but they really don't reject Rome's theology. That's the problem with a lot of folks today. But that got really nasty, and that got hot and heavy, but nothing like this past week. It's been pretty amazing that I would dare to raise substantive issues, questions concerning sola scriptura, the canon, indulgences, justification, stuff like how you're made right with God, in response to Frank Beckwith. How dare I do something like that? It's beyond all charitable activity. See, and of course, the big thing, I put up two absolutely spot on, perfect pictures that were just absolutely embodied the essence of the hypocrisy of the people who are out there going, "You need to be more charitable, you stupid idiotic moron." That's exactly, in fact, the funny thing is, I've been thinking about it, I hadn't mentioned this, aside from the fact that the commentary with the pictures was so plain and so clear and has been ignored by everybody. I had posted that first picture before, it just had Arabic on the sign. And I had posted it while I was out in Hawaii, speaking on a cruise out there, and no one complained about this, or if they did, you didn't bother sending them over to me, but nobody complained about the fact that I posted these things, that picture, and what I did then was I said, these are angry Dividing Line fans who were upset that for a whole week there wasn't going to be a Dividing Line. And did anybody have a cow over that? No, nobody had a cow over that, because it wouldn't help them to prop up their own position to have a cow over that. But I think that picture is absolutely hilarious. I mean, it's hilarious. These are people who've never read a word of Salman Rushdie, and they're just so into it, man. You can just tell that their imam has gotten gotten them going and must have passed out jelly beans or something during the service to get the sugar levels up, and they're just having a blast out there. They have no idea what they're yelling and screaming about, but they're having a good old time. And that's mob mentality, you know? That's just the way it is. I think that's funny because it's irrational, and that's why it was perfectly appropriate to post that in regards to people who were acting in the exact same way, just for a different religion. Anybody who goes, well, you're making all Catholics out to be terrorists, I'm sorry, but there is no way anyone can be quite that dull. You cannot possibly be quite that dull and to ignore the context which was posted, the words that were added, that were right there on the page next to it. So, anyway, absolutely perfectly nailed that. And then Jimmy Akin comes along and couldn't have helped me out more to illustrate the hypocrisy of these folks, but to do what he did. Couldn't have helped out more. Anybody who just sits back, I mean, there are Catholics who have had to admit, you know what, there was an obvious point, you know. I mean, if he was to be consistent, he must hate every single political cartoon that's ever been produced, because they're all the exact same thing. And the better the cartoon, you know what makes a good cartoon? Is that it captures the essence. It's like Angel. Angel's cartoons, he listens, he captures the essence of what's going on, and then you caricature the hypocrisy, you caricature the inconsistency, see? And that's what makes it funny. And, you know, Jimmy Akin can't handle that, well, what can I say? So, anyway, it's been a fascinating week of time, no two ways about it. Had no idea when I went on that bike ride Monday morning and listened to that Stand Reason program, what was going to, take place in the rest of the week. Absolutely an amazing thing. But sadly, the one thing that it has done for most people, no one's talking about Beckwith anymore. No one is outside of, have you noticed what's already happened? There's almost a hagiographer. A hagiography, I guess would be right now, that has developed in regards to Frank Beckwith in 1 week. In other words, it was fascinating. I pointed this, I may have pointed this on the air. When I went on the Catholic Answers forums right after he had appeared, there were people like Catholic Dude who were criticizing him because they recognized he just didn't do a good job if he was trying to be a Catholic apologist. Now, he denies he wants to be a Catholic apologist, which, of course, is why he's going on Catholic Answers and The Journey Home. He denies he's doing that. So, you know, I guess that means, well, okay, so I wasn't a good Catholic apologist. You know, I'm new at this. But I'm not really a Catholic apologist anyway, so you can't hold me to any particularly high standard. But there were Catholics on the board who were criticizing him. Then he showed up, and all of a sudden, all criticism ended. Well, folks, whether he's there or not, did he do a good job or did he not do a good job? Did he answer the questions? Were the questions fair? Of course they were fair. And I think what really happened, and we played all this last week, of course, but especially when Greg Kokel asked that question that started the second hour that demonstrated that he had been doing some serious reading in regards to the concept of merit and the concept of indulgences and the treasury of merit and all these things, and he asks that thorough question, and Beckwith responds with, is there a question? And then, well, you know, I thought I didn't expect this, and I thought this was going to be a safe place for me to share my journey and blah, 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 blah. I think that's where the tide shifted, shall we say, in essence. So the question is, did he do a good job or not? Whether he's listening or not, your answer should be the same. Hello? If you say one thing because you think someone isn't ever going to see what you're saying, and then when they show up, you say something else, maybe this is a term we need to do basic vocabulary 101 on. That's called hypocrisy, okay? If you're going to, you know, say something, then be honest and straightforward about it right off the bat, okay? And if they were right in criticizing him before he showed up, then why did that criticism all of a sudden stop? And now all of a sudden, oh, everybody is just, you know, so welcoming and welcome home to Rome, and you did such a wonderful job, and Coco was so mean to you, and blah, 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 blah. That's what you're getting. And what does that tell you? If it changes all of a sudden, where did truth go? Truth flew right out the window. What can I say? So there's almost this hagiography developing about him already. You know, he's sort of a martyr now because he's been criticized for coming home to Rome. I mean, the amazing thing is they want to use him as another Pauline convert. You know, the light comes down from heaven, and here the president of ETS, which means he knew everything there was to know about what it means to be a convinced evangelical, blah, 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 and now he's come home to Rome, see. And that's what they want this to look like, but it doesn't work that way. It just doesn't function that way. And you just know that they want to use it in this way. They want to, you know, the next volume of Surprised by Truth, you know, and all the rest of this stuff. But if you're going to do that, then the guy really has to have known what he was talking about. He has to have been a convinced evangelical. He has to have known what the issues were. And sadly, folks, there are so many in evangelicalism today that just don't. It's not that they are non-Catholics by choice and by conviction and by knowledge. They're non-Catholics by taste and predilection. They're just non-Catholics by tradition. And that's totally different than actually being a non-Catholic because you know what Catholicism is, you know what your faith is, and you recognize that the two are not compatible with one another. And you are passionate about the differences. You're passionate about a perfect work of atonement. You're passionate about a perfect work of justification. That it's not a legal fiction. I mean, whew, man, anybody who can allow that kind of blasphemy of the right of God as judge to declare his people righteous on the basis of the perfect work of Christ and their union with him as a legal fiction, let that just flow off of their tongue, you know, within just a matter of weeks of becoming a convert, really makes you wonder if there had ever been any passionate trust in that finished work before. Because, man alive, I cannot imagine what it would be like if I were in his shoes to make that kind of a statement. I really, really, really don't know how that works. That's just beyond me. So anyway, so I've got some material I want to share here. We've already got two callers online, so I'm going to go ahead and get to them in a moment. But I want to go back and I want to continue looking at the Bible Answer Man broadcast. And I do so in light of the fact that Catholic Answers has, for a very long time, styled this as a debate. And over and over again, I've said, it is not a debate. Oh, you're lost, and so you're just trying to blah, 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 blah. As I was listening to it, first of all, I was very thankful as I was listening to it that they distributed it, because I thought it went very, very well. But more than that, in the back of my mind, I'm going, why is this? Why do they keep pressing a 12-year-old radio program rather than pressing us to do more debates? I mean, if they're right about all this stuff, and if I'm as stupid and vile and despicable and as much of a troll as they say I am, you would think they'd be lining up on this radio program to demonstrate how much of an idiot I am. And that doesn't happen. And they'd be wanting to do debates. Remember, they're the ones who first challenged me in 1990 to debate them, and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm sitting here thinking, okay, what is going to cause, what's really behind all this? And so as I was listening to it, especially got in the second hour, all of a sudden I figured out exactly why it is that they want to keep pushing this. And from Jimmy Akin's perspective, I'm going to make this prediction. He would prefer it. This is the only thing that's ever made available. I don't think he ever wants to do a debate at all. You know why? As I was listening, as I was writing, I started doing some mental figuring. And so when I got back, I think it was that evening, I fired up the second hour. In the second hour, we discussed justification. In the first hour, I'd say it was pretty even time-wise on the subject of sola scriptura. But the second hour was on justification. And as I was writing, I could recognize there was a very large disparity as far as time goes. And so I sat down, and I fired up two timers on my computer, fired up the waveform, and I started measuring. I started taking measurements, started measuring the amount of time each one of us spoke during that second hour. Here's what I typed out. I said, in the second hour of the BAM program, a discussion of justification took place. Before callers began to be taken, I and Aiken were given time to present our views. During that time period, James Aiken was given a total of 18 minutes and 39 seconds to present his side. I was given 11 minutes and 19 seconds. That means Aiken had over 7 minutes more time than I was allowed. That is, of the time that was allotted for this vital discussion, Aiken got 62.2% of it, while I got 37.8%, almost a two-thirds versus one-third split. No wonder they want to call this thing a debate. If this were a formal debate, it would mean that'd be like Aiken getting a 38-minute opening statement to my own 22-minute opening statement. The rest of the hour only widened the gap due to callers, with Aiken ending up for just that 1 hour with 23 minutes and 55 seconds of airtime to my own 12 minutes and 38 seconds. That is, he got over 65% of the time. I got 35% of the time. So if you want to call something a debate where one side gets to talk two-thirds of the time to one-third of the other side, I can see why they want to promote this as a debate. But see, that's the problem, is that in a debate, it's not supposed to work that way. Now, for some reason, Rome needs that. Remember the Tim Staples debate on papal infallibility? Remember that even though prior to the debate, I stood behind the curtain up there, there's a stage in Fullerton, and I met with the moderator, Jerry Usher, who you hear on Catholic Answers Live all the time, and Tim Staples. And we talked about the format of the debate. And one of the things that was emphasized was that in cross-examination, if you are doing the questioning, that's all you do. You ask questions. You don't argue. You don't make statements. You ask questions. And so what happened when we got to the cross-examination period? Tim Staples begins a statement. I'm just going to take a second. No, don't worry. Just going to take a second. Starts a statement to answer the last thing that I had said. And, of course, all the students are like, you know, when he gets done with the statement. Violation of rule number one, Jerry Usher does nothing. Then, I believe someone counted up. I haven't taken time to do it. They counted four or five distinct questions. So what he does is he makes these big, long questions that fill the statements, just like Jerry Matatix, who's always doing all this rhetorical stuff before he ever gets to a question. And I have to interrupt him and try to respond to that. Well, that's not a question. Well, you're supposed to be asking questions, so what you're saying is you're violating the rules here with that, and I'm going to respond to what you said. And four or five questions, I believe we had 12 minutes, as I recall, in the cross-examination period. So four or five questions in 12 minutes. And then when you listen to, now his time ends, now it's my time to ask questions. And if I recall, the gentleman who counted the four or five for him counted 41 for me. 41 questions. I did not violate the rules. I asked questions. And, of course, he melted down. Was stuttering and stammering and shaking and everything else because you can't defend papal infallibility, and once you've now violated the rules up one side, down the other, in a very obvious way, I tend to become a tad bit focused, shall we say, in the questioning that I'm making. And it seems that Rome recognizes we need more time. We are the infallible church, but the infallible church needs more time than these heretics do to make our point and to prove that we're infallible, see. So, we get two-thirds of the time, you get one-third. We can break all the rules, you know, the question. And in fact, I'm going to be putting some video up. I've just just found, I think, that these are the oldest videotapes of any of my debates currently available. Now, I should mention something. I'm going to be, one of the two that I'm putting up is of a man by the name of Scott Butler. Now, I don't know what has happened to Scott Butler. He seems to have sort of, you know, vanished off the scene a little bit. But Scott Butler was one of the first people that I ran into. In fact, Scott Butler was involved in the very first debate with Catholic Answers and got into a fight with Catholic Answers over who got the videotape of that debate. And Scott Butler continues to have the videotape of my first debate to this very day. No one's ever seen it. And then he had the videotape of the debates with Mitch Pacwa, the first two debates I did with Mitch Pacwa in January of 1991 in El Cajon, California. Very large Catholic church on justification and the Mass. Now, he still has those tapes, unless he's done the Nixon thing with them, which I would certainly hope is not the case, but if he has, then I would wonder why. But Scott Butler has those videotapes, and I am calling on Scott Butler to provide us with those videotapes, to do what we have done with every Roman Catholic that we have ever videotaped something for. We have provided them with an unedited master that they have been able to do anything they want with. And I'm calling on Scott Butler to release the tapes, the videotapes, of the first debate that I did with Jerry Mattox in August of 1990 in Long Beach, and the videotapes of the two debates at in El Cajon with Mitch Pacwa. Send us raw footage that we can then put into DVD format. We've done that with everybody else. Ask Mitch Pacwa. Ask everyone on Long Island. When we did the videotaping, they received a videotape at no cost or charge. He wants, back when that happened, he wanted us to pay $5,000 to get those tapes. And so one of the people, like I said, these tapes that I ran across, I was looking for something else. I was looking for, actually, the clip that's on the blog right now with Jerry Mattox and the Marion stuff in regards to the Steve Ray blog. And I ran across the videotapes from the 1995 debate on the papacy, where Rob Zins and I debated Robert St. Genis and Scott Butler. And I'm putting two segments of that up because St. Genis had just done a rebuttal period, and he had just gone after me big time. But Bob's just not the best speaker, and it was boring. I mean, it was just sort of monotone, boring, and Bob has never figured out how to use a clock because he's always halfway through a word when his time goes out, and he just stops and walks off. You know, there's never any conclusion. There's no wrapping up. I'm watching the clock and want to try to wrap things up so there's at least a logical point where you stop. So the first one that I'm going to post is my response at that point where I'm going after the whole issue of the claims that have been made and things like that. And then after that is Butler's rebuttal of me, where he's literally turning toward me, and he's spitting. He is yelling so loud that I had to literally keep from doing a wipe my face routine with my hand, because he's completely losing it right at the end, yelling at me. I mean, it's an amazing thing to watch him get wound up. He's getting redder and redder, and then just blows up at the end. And you will notice in those that I look very different than I do now. I was riding 5,600 to over 6,000 miles a year on the bike at that time. Long rides, you know, plus 100-mile rides and stuff like that. So I was skinny as a rail, weighed about 170 pounds. And, of course, I've heard someone say, "Hey, man, gained 100 pounds just to intimidate his debate opponents." You know? It doesn't matter what I do, you know. They're going to find a way to go nuts about it. So anyway, those will be appearing probably starting tomorrow on the blog, so keep an eye out for them. But it's just another example of where at one point I say in the rebuttal, I say, "Now, in fact, if our opponents would stay in the room, they might hear what our arguments are," because they kept leaving. That's the most amazing thing I've ever watched in my life. Was you know, Art Sippo gets up and walks out while I'm talking, because he doesn't need to know what I have to say. He doesn't care what I have to say. He's the Roman Catholic. I'm a heretic. Who cares? And here in 1995 at Boston College, St. Genis leaves the room while we're talking. Butler leaves the room while we're talking. They don't. You know, how in the world are you supposed to respond to what the other side has to say if you're not even listening? I've never done that. And the only person, at least I can give some credit on this to, I mean, Pack was never done that, but I've had a number of Roman Catholic opponents who have never done that, but I've had the only opponents I've ever had who've walked out of the room while I was speaking during debate were Roman Catholics. They're the only ones. Nobody else has done it. Muslims haven't. King James only folks haven't. Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, nobody else has done it. Only Roman Catholics seem to have the feeling that they don't need to hear what the heretic has to say. They already know it all. And so we don't have to even bother with that. And you know, at least Pat Madrid, when we did the Sola Scriptura debate in 1993, asked that the debate be stopped before the final presentations because he needed to use the restroom again. Rather than just walking out while I'm doing mine, he said, could we stop so that he wouldn't miss what I was having to say? So I should mention that just in passing, because that was the, you know. Anyway, all right, let's, we've got a bunch of callers, to go to here, and I believe the first one to call in anyways was, Jeff. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing great, Dr. White. How you doing?
Doing good.
Good. I'm glad to be talking with the author of All That Is Evil in the Roman Catholic world.
And don't forget, uncharitable at all points.
Yes, you should be burned.
Well, be careful, because I tried using that humor once with Jerry Mattix, remember? In the very first debate I did with Jerry, we were at the Coral House in Baldwin, and there was a fire in the fireplace right behind us. And so I made a joke about, not feeling overly comfortable right next to the wooden fire like that. Ha, 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 ha. And Jerry spent, I don't know how long of his next rebuttal period, talking about how Catholics had been killed by Protestants and all this stuff. It's like everybody's sitting in the audience going, Jerry, it was a joke. Hello. You know, I mean, he can then turn around later and tell a really what I thought was totally off the wall joke about when the woman was taken in adultery and Jesus says, let you who are without sin cast the first stone. A stone goes flying by Jesus and he turns and says, Mom, and he tells that in the middle of a debate. So he can do that, but I can't, you know, like I said, the double standards are absolutely incredible.
But so anyway, before I get to the Beckwith stuff, I just want to say the set of Asyntist audio that you put up with Mattix, that was really, really fascinating.
What little of it I got to say.
but just even the first hour with him, I would love to have him listen to a debate between him and, like, a traditional Roman Catholic.
Well, I know that, what's happening is Chris Arnzen is trying to get he and Syngenis on, because Syngenis is probably one of the only people who would take Jerry on. You're not going to ever see Jimmy Akin or Carl Keating or these guys taking on Mattix. They're not going to do it. And I would imagine once word gets out that Syngenis is considering it, that a lot of pressure is going to be put on him, too, because basically right now it seems to be the Roman Catholic apologetics community has gotten together and has said the way we're going to handle Mattix is to ignore him in toto. Nobody talk to him, nobody debate him, nobody dialogue with him, nobody mention him, except for Carl. He can take a shot at him once in a while, but just completely marginalize him and don't let him. We don't want to see people seeing us argue, because obviously what this does is it demonstrates that our argument against Sola Scriptura, our main argument against Sola Scriptura, actually doesn't work, because we're arguing with someone who used to be on our side.
Now, in regards to Beckwith, I was interacting, I think, after you stopped posting on the Stand to Reason blog entry.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a few observations. I found that fascinating as well. One of the things I had mentioned in the comment section was that it seems like Beckwith's pre-existing view of grace, it seems like he was impressed that Trent used grace. When just because they said grace was necessary, and I kind of likened it to the new perspective on Paul, where they say, hey, Second Temple Judaism was gracious because they used the word grace.
Right.
And they're kind of impressed with that.
Mm-hmm.
And where I brought up, where it says in Romans in a couple of places that if you add works to grace, it's no longer grace. And I think that the response, and Beckwith actually had a response a day or two ago. This is, of course, a big wielding back and forth, so it's not all of it directly in reply to me. But they wanted to say that if gracious and not works merit, because Christ does the work in you.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one where I have to have a big thanks to you of Val being consistent in your apologetic and your theology. Where I said, so if you take away perseverance of the saints, and you have everybody being, not everybody in Roman Catholic theology who comes under grace is going to be saved, right? So there has to be something that's not, you have to find the locus of boasting in man, not in God, because right. if you don't have preservation of the saints, if you don't have eternal security, or at least a reformed view of eternal security, what you have is that you basically have to say that it's gracious because God did the works in them, but I don't know why all these other people don't do those works.
Right.
Even though they were, you know, wasn't grace applied to them through the sacraments?
Exactly. The grace, while necessary, is insufficient to bring about the intention, which is the ultimate salvation of the elect of God. It still requires the additional actions of man. It's sort of what I call peanut butter grace. It's spread all over everybody. And I remember sitting in 1990, I believe it was 1990, during the PACWA debates in January of 1990 in San Diego in Scott Butler's office. He's a real estate guy. I was sitting in his office, and we were discussing these things. And one of the things, he said, look, we believe in sola gratia. We believe in grace alone. And I said, no, you don't. And he said, what do you mean I don't? I said, look, and I raised this very issue. The issue has never been the necessity of grace. The issue has always been the sufficiency of grace. And you know, I've been, honestly, at least I'm consistent, I've been saying that for almost two decades now very, very clearly. And sadly, a large number of evangelicals just are not listening to things like that. And so they run into, you know, someone friendly to Rome and says, oh, look at Trent. You know, Trent anathematized anyone who said you could be saved outside of the grace of Christ. Ooh, that's wonderful. That's great. I guess it's a whole lot better than I thought it was.
I've never met a legalist who says I'm a legalist, or a heretic who says I'm a heretic, or an antinomian who says I'm an antinomian.
Or a Pelagian who says he's a Pelagian. I think actually I did meet one once, so I guess I can't say that, but he was pretty weird. So, yeah, exactly. The ignorance of the main plain issues, sadly, is being very clearly documented in the situation, as it was back when John Paul died. It's every once in a while something comes up, it turns the spotlight back on it, and when we ask ourselves the question, within American post-evangelicalism, is it getting better or worse? There's only one answer I can give right now, and it ain't getting any better. So,
Beckwith tried to, he threw a thought out in the comment section near towards the end now, where he said, you know, kind of like the Bible is, you know, God's initiative, but like, you know, men participated in it.
Right.
And he wanted to say it was something similar to that. It was just like a brief thought. And
I saw that, and since I had not read the context of it, I didn't really know what in the world he was referring to. Now that makes it interesting.
I think it's in that whole grace is, you know, so Christ is doing work in people kind of thing. And, you know, I guess for the people who did get grace and don't do those works, they can't really explain. It's the same thing with the earlier with the purgatory and the treasury of merits.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
It's like there's so many inconsistencies there. I really am kind of at a loss to kind of explain, like, I think it's, a philosophy professor once told me the way people generally reason is they get premises and they get conclusions and kind of work towards the middle.
Yes.
and we all do that, but at the same time, like, there are so many inconsistencies there that, you know, that's why the set of vacantists thing was interesting, because you can see, okay, you have Roman Catholic presuppositions, he accepts there's contradictions, but he goes with the, instead of vacancies, as opposed to realizing, hey, papacy is not real.
Yeah, that's what I tried to bring out to him at the end was, you know what, if your presuppositions lead you to the conclusion that your ultimate authority is no longer your ultimate authority, if you're stuck in the circular situation he's stuck in, maybe what you need to realize is the mistake you made was in 1986, not in 1996 or anything else. It was that initial embracing of this ahistorical authority that has marked the rest of Maddox's work, and that's what the problem is. But hey,
one last quick thing. No one had an answer to your what I call the James White question of why the Old Testament Jews had a canon. There's no even remotely good answer on that.
They don't even. It's very much like what my mom tells me I did when I was 4 years old. Up in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, when I decided I wanted to run down the middle of County Road 15, right around the corner, was when she started chasing after me. I stuck my fingers in my ears so I would not hear her, so I would have a reason for my rebellion. Was I stuck my fingers in my ears so I couldn't hear you saying, stop, don't run down the middle of the road. And I don't see any difference here, I'm sorry. You cannot tell me these people do not know Just a couple weeks ago, Jimmy Akin had actually written to us and actually called Rich, and somebody had written to him, and Rich eventually sent me the email, and they had heard that question. Now, they completely warped it, and they got all of context, and they didn't really understand what he was saying, but it was that question. And Jimmy Akin's response to Rich was, oh, if that's all it is, that's easy. I've not seen what the easy response is, but I would love to see what his easy response is, and then compare it with the easy response provided by Patrick Madrid and by other people over the years. And if it's not the same response, well, that in and of itself says something right there. But anyways, hey, thanks for calling, Jeff.
All right, God
bless. Bye-bye. 877-753-3341. You know, I'd never even given the number. Everybody was calling anyways. That's pretty cool. Of course, there might be a few folks who want to get caught up after the past few weeks. Let's talk to, we have to go across the border. Going up to Canada, and talk to Mark. Hello, Mark.
Well, is this 1-800-UNCHARITABLE?
Yes, that's... No, it's 877-UNCHARITABLE. 800-UNCHARITABLE goes to somebody else, but we won't mention who it might be.
Okay. Yeah, I just had a question about the... You just posted a Mary sort of post about how Catholics try to defend that, the whole Queen of Heaven and all that stuff.
Yeah, I think you're referring to the post that appeared at midnight last night, my time, which was in response to Steve Ray's blog, where he is arguing for the queenship role of Mary on the basis of 1 Kings 2:19, where Solomon brings a throne in for his mother to sit upon. And then that becomes expanded out to, since Jesus is the perfect king, then he would do what the Israelite kings did, et cetera, et cetera. And that then leads to the idea of Mary as Queen of Heaven. Yes.
Yeah, it just inspired a question to me. And I was just wondering how is that different, let's say, or when the Mormons, they say this predicts Joseph Smith, or when the Muslims say, you know, these passages predict the Holy, or predict Muhammad. How's that different than how, like, the New Testament writers looked in the Old Testament to see Jesus? Like, where's the... I've been asked that question before,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm not really sure at... I know there must be a difference. No, they're the apostles. These people aren't. But, I mean, the Mormons would say, yeah, well, this is our apostle. And the Muslims would say, well, this was Muhammad.
Right.
You know, and I'm just wondering, how is it different? How is the typology different in how Rome is using these passages to defend Marian superiority or what have you, and us saying, you know, this passage, Hosea, you know, is talking about, you know, this is a typological usage to show that Jesus is going to come out of Egypt. Like, what's different? How can I point out the difference?
Right. That's an excellent question. And the answers are going to vary a little bit dependent upon the group. That is, for example, when a Muslim utilizes in Isaiah 9, when a Muslim, here's one I'm actually going to be addressing on the program, not too distant future, when a Muslim goes to the Arabic text of translations of the Bible and finds the name Muhammad in the Song of Solomon and makes that a prophecy of the coming of Muhammad, the final messenger, how you respond to that is going to be slightly different because of the historical context than how you respond to the Roman Catholic use of 1 Kings 2:19 or... how you would respond to the Jewish objection to the Hosea 11 passage, which you just mentioned. And the reason that there's a difference between each one is because of the foundation upon which the alleged prophecy is being placed. That is, for example, for the Muslim, there was no Arabic text of the Bible to refer to even in the days of Muhammad to begin with. And so what you're looking at there are mere what would be called literary accidents. That is, any one of us could take a particular word, and especially given Semitic languages where you have triliteral roots, make connections. It's sort of like saying Islam is a religion of peace because it's got shalom, S-L-M, in Islam, Muslim, shalom is peace, so on and so forth. But the problem is everybody knows trilateral roots can end up having all sorts of different meanings, and Islam actually means submission to God, not just the concept of peace. And so you can find those trilateral roots and make connections all over the place. Muslims actually do that. Most Christians aren't aware that they have Quranic codes, just like we had the Bible codes craze for a long period of time. And so every religion comes up with stuff like that. So you would address that in that context, and the fact that you're looking at someone who comes 600 years after the time of Christ, or in regards to Old Testament passages, sometimes as long as 2,000 years down the road, and that there's therefore no context in which to place that alleged prophetic announcement. In the same way, for the Roman Catholic, in regards to 1 Kings chapter 2, you demonstrate the fact that they can't keep the analogy consistent. That is, if there was this kind of consistency to the analogy, as I pointed out, then it would follow that Bathsheba would have received from Solomon what she desired from him, because the parallel would continue through to Mary's intercession before God, and the fact that the Roman Catholic has promised that Mary will obtain what she asks from Jesus. But that consistency isn't there. Secondly, the fact that it's a misuse of the establishment of an entire position or office that we just don't see in the rest of the Old Testament, that the throne had to be brought in 1 Kings chapter 2. So in other words, you can look at the actual context and say, look, the things that you are saying are most important about this just simply don't continue on. And third, for the Roman Catholic, the early church did not understand it the way that the Roman Catholic does. If the Roman Catholic is going to try to argue some kind of consistency of tradition over time, these Marian doctrines, especially the Marian doctrines from Immaculate Conception through bodily assumption to queenly coronation and all the rest of these things, they're just simply not known in the early church. These are just beliefs that just weren't there. They came from Gnostic sources, even when they did. I mean, some of these, even the Gnostics weren't wild enough to dream up in those years. It has taken centuries and centuries beyond them to come up with anything even remotely like what Rome has now dogmatized or has considered dogmatizing in the concept of Mary as co-redemptrix, co-mediatrix, and advocate for the people of God. So that's the next thing. But when you get to New Testament utilizations, what you have are Jewish people utilizing the Jewish scriptures and finding in those Jewish scriptures these references to an individual that at that time, both Jews and Christians, and remember, we look at Jews and Christians now as utterly separate, distinct entities. At the time of the ministry of Christ, there wasn't such a distinction. All the followers of Jesus were Jewish. And even for a long period after that, you look at what happens, for example, in the 6th century, sixth decade of the 1st century, when the Romans expelled the Jews from Rome. Well, the Christians got expelled too, because from the Romans' perspective, they're all the same. They didn't even make a differentiation between them. And you have in Acts the fact that the apostles are going into the synagogues and they're preaching there, because there is this direct connection between the two. But the context is of individuals who are believing Jews. They say that they are continuing to worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and everyone is expecting Messiah. And the prophetic speculation found in the intertestamental period is quite fascinating. Now, obviously, because of their external circumstances, a lot of that prophetic speculation is focused upon those prophecies of the Messiah, where the Messiah destroys the enemies of Israel. And so there was primarily, even in the ministry of Jesus, even after Jesus' own teaching, his apostles are going, well, is now the time when you're going to restore the kingdom of Israel? Now, you know, even before the ascension, that type of thing is going on. But you have individuals who are immersed in the context of the Old Testament scriptures, and they believe the Old Testament scriptures, and they hold the Old Testament scriptures. And it's not that they're just ransacking the Old Testament looking for anything that could be wildly attached, because honestly, there's a whole lot more that could have been utilized in that way that simply wasn't. Instead, the prophecies that are attached are prophecies where, if you look back, for example, I don't have time today, it's quarter till and we've got four more callers on the line, so I need to try to hurry this up. I tend to be a little bit difficult in doing that, but when you look at, for example, the Isaiah 7 prophecy of Emmanuel, there's clearly an immediate fulfillment of that within the time of Isaiah in regards to the peoples who were attacking Israel. But at the same time, when you look at the exalted language that is utilized and the extent to which the prophecy is given and what it involves, there seems to be much more to it than that. And then Isaiah himself expands on that in both Isaiah 9 and Isaiah 10 on the same theme, where there isn't an immediate fulfillment. And there couldn't be. I mean, the person of Isaiah 7, seen then again Isaiah 9, who ever lived in that day that could possibly be described as Tsar Shalom and El Gabor and Aviad and things like that? There's just no one who actually can fulfill that. And so the utilization of those prophecies comes really with a context within it that is applicable. And now the Jewish apologists, you know, this is where I think a lot more work needs to be done. There's some good books that have been done. William Webster's done a good book on it, some others. Hengstenberg's work on Christ in the Old Testament. These unfortunately are not the most popular works that are available today, but this is part and parcel of the life of the New Testament church. And that's why the book of Hebrews just assumes such a large knowledge of the sacrificial system and the content of the Old Testament, and hence going into it, utilizes it as its primary argumentation, because that's what the early church had to use. So I see a vast difference between being able to go into those Old Testament passages and arguing that as a whole they are pointing toward this fulfillment, and the sacrifices clearly indicated that because of their repetition, for example, in Hebrews 10, that there had to be a greater fulfillment and things like that. There's a direct connection within the Jewish community to that that you don't have, certainly don't have with the Islamic application. I didn't even get into the Mormon stuff because, I mean,
definitely.
I mean, you know, obviously Joseph Smith had to come up with a whole new chapter in Genesis just to make that work. So, I mean, that's yeah, go ahead.
As a quick recap, then, is it basically the difference is that for the apostles, what they were using was an expected thing, while for nobody was expecting another prophet with Muhammad or Joseph Smith. Nobody was expecting Mary all of a sudden to become the Queen of Heaven, but people were expecting a Messiah, and so it's a totally different sort of
That's one aspect of it. It's not the entire aspect, but that is one, I think, very appropriate aspect. That does allow the Christian interpretation of the Old Testament to be examined in a different light than Joseph Smith making up a new chapter in Genesis, or the Muslim looking at a later translation of the Arabic Old Testament after the time of Muhammad and finding a connection to Ahmed in the description of the lover in Song of Solomon, of how beautiful the lover is, and that somehow becomes a reference to Muhammad. There's no connection there between the themes of that book and the Old Testament as a whole and Muhammad coming, you know, 2,000 years later. There's no connection there, whereas there is clearly the connection of the prophecies of the Messiah and things like that in the Old Testament that then become fulfilled in the New. Okay?
Great. Excellent.
All right, thanks, Mark. All right, thanks for calling. God bless. Bye-bye. 877-753-3341. Let's pick up the pace here and head up to Cameron. Hi, Cameron. How you doing? Hello, Cameron.
Oh, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Hello, Dr. White. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Hi, I was looking at your blog the other day, and just looking at the discussion you had with Jonathan Frigida.
Yes, uh-huh.
And I wish I could ask him this question, but I guess I'm just going to ask you. I don't know how fair that is, but I'll ask you anyways. So basically what I was hearing from him as he was talking was that he was basically relating or saying that because Christians, believers, are somehow engrafted into Christ by the Spirit, and because Christ... because of looking at the hypostatic union of Christ, and that somehow because the believer is somehow united into Christ, maybe like John 17:20 would support that,
mm-hmm.
That we are one with Christ, or Ephesians 1:13, you know, that we united with him and everything. And so what I would like to ask him, but I guess I'll just ask you what you would think of this question, is basically, does that mean that believers ought to be able to worship other believers, if we use that same logic as to why the Catholic would believe that we're able to worship saints and Mary and whatnot because of that same logic?
Well, yeah, and I'll try to give as best a response I can, recognizing that I clearly find, and for those who have not listened to the calls, I posted two links on my blog. The first to a call that Jonathan Prejean gave me in 2004 that was very calm, cool, and collected. The second one to last year's call where after he had accused me of Nestorianism and everything else, he called up and we had an almost 15-minute conversation, which I ended, I hung up on him. And, of course, they're now using that as an example. And those of you who listen to this program regularly are have to chuckle at this. The example of why no one should ever call, because I just simply hang up on people. As I pointed out, Mr. Prejean's gotten about 37 minutes of airtime. I can guarantee you if I started calling Catholic Answers Live, I would not get 37 minutes of airtime in any way, shape, or form. But anyway, in the second call, the point of argumentation, for those who haven't heard it, was basically that due to the hypostatic union, the relationship of the divine and the human in Christ, and our union with him, this was being used, in essence, as a defense for the Roman Catholic concept of giving of the distinction between dulia, hyperdulia, and latria, and the concept of the worship of God and the giving of hyperdulia to Mary and dulia to the saints. Is that because Christ has entered into the physical realm, that there is something that in essence has happened that allows a transference in some way, shape, or form of that being able to give honor to that which is creaturely. And so I asked him what to me is an obvious question, and that is, was not the incarnation unique in its nature, in its event? And what people need to understand is the reason I hung up on Mr. Prejean was that after I asked him a biblical question based upon John 1:14, the Word became flesh, and I said, is that not a unique event? In other words, would that not be completely different than making application to anyone else, including those who are united in a redemptive sense with Jesus Christ? And personally, I am deeply offended when people will use biblical language but do not do their biblical homework. And I am deeply offended when biblical truths, for example, if you want to get me upset, draw a parallel between the evidence for the blessed doctrine of the Trinity in Scripture and one of these Roman Catholic dogmas that are not defined for 500, 1,000, 1,500, or 2,000 years after the time of Christ, as if there's somehow a parallel between them. That, to me, is extremely offensive to God, to his truth, to the clarity and perspicuity and inspiration of the Bible. And I find that offensive. It's not that it's offensive to me as an individual. I feel sorry for anybody who's going to have to stand before God and answer for making that kind of, I think, blasphemous statement, but I find it offensive to my God. And so when Mr. Prejean stuttered and stammered, dead air, in response to that question, because it was a biblical question, it was an exegetical question rather than a question based upon spending hours and hours reading Cyril of Alexandria, that was offensive to me. And when he began to laugh at my focusing upon the biblical revelation rather than spending the rest of the hour discussing the oddities of Cyril of Alexandria's writings, I found that so offensive that that I hung up on him. But I'm not sure how he would answer that outside of the utilization of the unbiblical distinction between latria, hyperdulia, and dulia, but it did seem to me that his argument had something to do with the idea that that union does provide some basis, not only for icons and images and things like that, but for the practices that have grown up along those lines as well. So that's the best I can do for you. I believe he has a blog. You can Google Crimson Catholic and ask him directly if you'd like to. But being an attorney, be expecting a very long and convoluted response. My apologies to all attorneys, but it has been my experience that giving a succinct response is probably not going to happen. You're going to get a rather full one. But I don't have any problem with anybody Googling him, looking him up, and asking him, because honestly, I think for the person who loves the Word of God and loves God's truth, the uniqueness of the incarnation event is so clear that even when you emphasize our union with Christ, that union is a gracious union, and it is a union that does not ontologically change us. And the union of the divine and human And the hypostatic union in regards to Christ does not change creation itself in the sense that the laws of God about communication with the dead or the nature of worship does not change the clarity and perspicuity of those fundamental laws of God that are found in His Word. And to say that it does, to me, is the height of sophistry.
Okay. Okay, well, I think I'm going to search him out and try to see what he has to say about that.
Okay.
And maybe try to find his blog. So, but I appreciate it.
All right, thanks a lot. Thanks,
John.
Bye-bye. All right, let's press on here. We only have a few minutes left, and talk with Lawrence again. Hi, Lawrence.
Yes, calling from California.
Yes, sir.
I wonder, maybe you have a an idea why people don't call your program with to defend opposite views. I hear callers that seem to agree with you or ask questions. And it seems that it's rare to me that Catholics or people that would agree with Catholic views, in my case being Orthodox, would kind of give up on calling. Do you sense that this trend as well, or how do you explain it?
I explain it, to be honest with you, Roman Catholic apologists in general tend to prefer a monologue over a dialogue. That is, while Catholic Answers was very small back in the 1980s, they did seek the notoriety that would come with debating basically fundamentalists that did not have any knowledge of church history or Roman Catholic theology. But once we came on the scene, all of a sudden that has changed, and now that they have national radio programs and they have a larger audience, they're primarily interested in a monologue, not in a dialogue as far as that is concerned. And quite honestly, especially in regards to areas like the Marian dogmas and in regards to the papacy and regards to the claims of the See of Rome, especially in the first five centuries, as you undoubtedly would be well aware, a dialogue just doesn't really work. For a conservative Roman Catholic who is attempting to substantiate the claims of papal primacy. Now, for an ecumenical Roman Catholic who doesn't have nearly as much of a an interest or an axe to grind, okay, fine, that's one thing. But for the Catholic apologist that has a very strong believing base, they're not going to want them really finding out what Leo actually said or what Chalcedon actually said. They don't want hearing a fair discussion of the 28th Canon of the Council of Chalcedon, and they're not going to really want a fair discussion of what happened during the Arian ascendancy after the Council of Nicaea or things like that, because it just doesn't reflect well on their position. And so, in general, you just don't have that kind of dialogue taking place.
If I may make a comment, I remember maybe 3 years ago you had a program where you discussed receiving tapes from Jerry Metaddix, and in the tape he made the case that, you know, Mary and the Ark have this and you seem to be bothered by this being a possibility. So you said, oh, if that's real, it's pretty devastating, and it seems to me that it's a good case. I mean, do you think
Actually, you misunderstood me. What I said was, when I received the tapes from Jerry, he presented the material in such a rapid-fire manner that what I said was, man, if that's real, I've never heard anyone talking about these things. But then what I went on to say is, I then took the tapes home, sat down in front of the computer with BibleWorks, and instead of just rat-a-tat-tat rapid-fire, when he would say, for example, the Greek word here in the Septuagint is the same thing that Luke uses of the Shekinah glory. Okay, now I can hit pause, and I can go into the Septuagint, and I can bring up the term, and I can go to Luke, and I can do a full search. And what I said was, I found that at each and every point his case collapsed, that he was not speaking the truth. And so it was the biblical examination of that argumentation that, to me, then became the foundation of the debate that we did in 1996, I believe it was, on Long Island on the subject of Mary. And I was able, I think, to demonstrate that the argumentation he was using was exceptionally poor. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen those debates. They were rather rapid fire because we covered four dogmas in one debate. So you didn't have a whole lot of time. But I still felt that there was sufficient time for us to develop fairly clearly the fact that it was really taking a gross amount of special pleading on his part to make that kind of an argument. And it would be interesting to me, though we don't have time today to develop it, where, as it is, we're going over time just to take your call and then the call for from David up in Washington, and we'll wrap things up. It would seem odd to me that you would find it to be much of a compelling case, simply because of the fact that it's the exact same argumentation they use to go beyond what you, as an Orthodox person, accept as appropriate teaching on Mary, to the point where they've dogmatized things that the Eastern Orthodox do not accept to be dogma at all. And,
correct.
And if I'm not incorrect, is part of the main ecumenical dialogues right now. And in fact, one of the arguments against the dogmatization of Mary as co-redemptrix, mediatrix, and advocate for the people of God, as I understand it,
yes,
was that it would cause a major stumbling block in the ecumenical dialogues of the East.
Correct, correct. But do you think there's no possibility, just to wrap up, that there's no chance that in any shape or form the Ark is a type of Mary?
Well, let's put it this way. If someone were to make that kind of an argument, I would want to ask, why is it, if that is the case, that not only is that not a part of the New Testament reflection on the subject, why is that also not a part of the early church's reflection, depending on how you want to define early church? You have to have developments in the early church, specifically in regards to the concept. First of all, you have to have Irenaeus coming up with the Eve-Mary parallel. And then that has to become expanded in the next generation due to the rise of the Eastern Fathers and monasticism, the influx of what I would call an unbiblical view of sexuality, before you have any type of a fertile soil into which various Gnostic ideas from the Gnostic Gospels are placed, that then give rise to what we see in the 4th century in the blaspheming of Marian theology. And from that point, then, sure, you get all sorts of discussions of it. But as I look at it, I don't see any reason to believe that that was anything the apostles ever came up with. And as such, I don't see any reason to put any weight into it at all. I mean, you can come up with all sorts of allegorical interpretations regarding all sorts of New Testament events, but if the apostles and those who were taught by the apostles did not see those things, I don't see any reason to put any weight into it. So when you say it's impossible, I'm not going to say anything is impossible on that line, but I don't see any reason to believe it. And I certainly don't, and I certainly find it offensive when someone then takes that and dogmatizes it and makes it a de fide dogma that I somehow have to believe on the same level as the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which is what Jerry Matetics does with the bodily assumption of Mary.
I agree on that point.
Okay. Hey, thank you for calling. We're out of time. I'm going to get one more call in. Thanks for calling, Lauren.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And let's real quickly grab David. David, we've gone over time just for you.
Oh, well, thank you. I don't know if this would be a quick question or not. It pertains to the contrast between the necessity of grace and the sufficiency of grace.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that, at least from my reading, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you're using the phrase sufficiency of grace differently than it's been used historically. From my reading of Paul and guys like Ott and even Charles Hodge, they're using it in a much different sense.
Now, did you just say Ott as in Ludwig Ott?
Yes.
That's quite a stretch to put Hodge and Ludwig Ott in the same breath, but go ahead and explain what you mean.
Well, for instance, Paul, I think he's the clearest on this. He contrasts efficacious grace with sufficient grace. This is what he says of sufficient grace. Sufficient grace is that divine assistance whereby God communicates to the human will full power to perform a salutary act, but not the action itself.
Okay, now who are you quoting?
Paul. He has a systematic theology, about 12 volumes set, and he has one on grace, a volume just on grace.
Please spell this because your phone's very muffled.
I'm sorry, P-O-H-L-E.
Okay, all right, thank you. I thought you were saying Paul, and I'm going, I don't remember that one in Romans.
Sorry.
But yeah, it's the bass tones on your phone are at least in my headphones, are a lot more than the higher tones. But okay, so
okay,
I'll try all
to
right.
speak a little bit closer.
That's okay. Yeah, I am not utilizing the term in that way at all. I am discussing instead here, I'm not talking about that kind of definition of grace at all, especially in that context where it sounds like grace is being defined as something that merely brings man to a point of moral neutrality so he can make a proper decision. Not using that at all. I am contrasting the difference between those who say that God's grace is necessary in whatever form. All synergists would say that God's grace is necessary to bring about salvation, over against the Reformed understanding that God's grace is sufficient to bring about his purposes in the salvation of his elect, so that it is both necessary and sufficient. Oh, that would be a monergistic understanding, versus those who would say it is necessary only, but God's grace can try to save but fail outside of the addition of, and then you can either have a very short list or a very long list, depending on where you fall in the synergistic spectrum. But yeah, I'm talking about the difference between whether God saves alone, monergistically, or whether God saves synergistically, and the relative amount of his work can be very large or very small, depending on where you fall in the synergistic spectrum.
Well, that's how I thought you were using it, but
yes.
I don't see any historical precedent for that specific usage.
I would say the entire Reformation is a historical precedent.
But no, I mean specifically the contrast between the necessity of grace and the sufficiency of grace. Because sufficient, to me, in a classical definition, means that it is a sufficient. And by that, it doesn't preclude cooperation.
Well,
that's
sufficient to do what?
Sufficiency.
Yeah, sufficient to do what? If you define
to enable.
That's exactly where the Reformation and Rome differed. Have you read Freedom? The debate between Erasmus and Luther?
No, I have not.
Okay, Luther identified his debate with Erasmus over the freedom of the bondage of the will as the hinge upon which it all turns, the key issue separating Roman Catholicism and the Reformers, and that is, and that's why I say the entire Reformation is documentation of the historical existence of this use of the term sufficiency, that is, it is not simply sufficient to allow for a free act, it is sufficient to actually accomplish the intention of God in the salvation of his elect people. And so, sadly, the majority of post-evangelicals today would line up with Erasmus against the Reformers at this point, because they're all over in the necessity but not sufficiency range, because God is trying to save everybody but failing regularly in fulfilling his actual heart's intention. And as a self-consistent, I would hope, Reformed theologian, I believe that Jesus Christ, the perfect Savior, he will not lose any of those that are given to him, and those that are given to him are given to him by God's free grace, not on the basis of their fulfilling any kind of conditions, whether by sufficient grace or any other type of grace. So that's where we would differ there. David, thank you very much. We kept you 7 minutes over. And appreciate the phone call today. Hopefully that clears things up for a lot of folks. Hey, thanks for the phone call. They never got back to the Battle Ants Man broadcast, but you know what? Obviously, some folks in the audience needed to discuss some things we've been talking about, and hopefully that clarified things for everybody. We will be back, Lord willing, Thursday afternoon here on The Dividing Line. We'll try to get to the Bible Ants Man discussion and your calls. See you then. God bless.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracts. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.